Henry Morton Stanley, Through the Dark Continent. Now, we went 2 months ago on the first part of the incredible life of Henry Morton Stanley, who fought both sides of the American War between the states, who was involved in the Abyssinian campaign, the Ghana campaign, finding David Livingstone, all of the rest of it. And so today we are dealing with Through the Dark Continent. This is one of the most incredible epic adventures and exploration feats in history. Henry Morton Stanley saw Africa as a challenge. He saw David Livingstone as his example and his inspiration. And Stanley dedicated his life to serving Africa by developing Christianity and civilization throughout the vast, unexplored interior of Africa. On the 18th of April, 1874, Henry Morton Stanley was one of the pallbearers for the funeral of Dr. David Livingstone at Westminster Abbey. And Stanley was given the foremost position on the right. Shortly after that, the Daily Telegraph of London and the New York Herald united to fund an expedition to Central Africa under the leadership of Henry Morton Stanley to complete the work left unfinished by the lamentable death of David Livingstone, to solve, if possible, the remaining problems of the geography of Central Africa and to investigate and report upon the haunts of the slave traders. On the 15th of August, 1874, Stanley and three volunteers set sail from England to Zanzibar, and he sought the men who had served him on the Livingstone search expedition or who had served with Livingstone. Ultimately, he selected 356 carriers and soldiers. And on 12th of November, 1874, loaded with animals and supplies, they set sail for Bagamoyo on the coast of East Africa, and immediately had to deal with those of his men who began stealing and assaulting the local inhabitants. Then, when he found that some had kidnapped women, he forced them to set them free. He then faced down a mutiny, and there were desertions, and they passed through areas of severe famine, and their guides deserted, and new guides got them lost. This is Africa. January 1875 began with a series of severe hardships and catastrophes. Men died from the heat, from lack of food, and from exhaustion. Local inhabitants were hostile and severely overcharged the expedition for food. Sickness plagued the men. In the first 2 months, 20 people died and 89 deserted. One-third of the expedition was lost. Then the Ituru natives attacked the expedition. In just one battle, the expedition lost 21 askaris, their soldiers. When Stanley reached Lake Victoria, he called on volunteers to man the boat that he called the Lady Alice, interestingly named after that strange girl that he met early on in his life. Must have had an impact on him. The men declared that they were cowards on the water. So thereafter, Stanley dispensed with asking for volunteers and just selected and ordered his men, "You're going to man the boats," and so on. Beginning on the 8th of March, 1875, Stanley began exploring Lake Victoria, establishing that it was, without doubt, the largest lake in Africa, covering 26,000 square miles. Stanley sailed along and mapped its 2,000 miles of shoreline, recording every cove, river, and island connected with it. Frequently, he faced savage people, often drunk, screaming their intention to kill him. His calm and confident demeanor prevented conflict. In April, he met with Mtesa, the Kabaka, or the King of Uganda, or Baganda. John Hanning Speke had written of Mtesa. Mtesa claimed to be a Muslim who had been converted to Islam by an Arab, Muli bin Salim. Stanley determined to destroy his belief in Islam and teach the doctrines of Christ. And so for 12 days, Henry Morton Stanley instructed the king from the Old and the New Testaments. And at the end, Mtesa announced he would follow the Christian Sabbath. He would instruct that the Ten Commandments be written on the board where everyone could see them and study them every day. And Mtesa then loaned Stanley canoes and men to explore the western shores of Lake Victoria. Colonel Linant de Belfont was sent out by General Charles Gordon, governor of Sudan, to establish communications with Uganda. Stanley entrusted him with a letter to the Daily Telegraph appealing for missionaries to be sent to Uganda to follow up on his work. Belfons was murdered in Sudan, But Stanley's letters were discovered concealed in his boot. When they eventually found their way to England, were published by the Telegraph, a huge fund was collected and missionaries were sent out to Uganda, where Christianity began to flourish. And today, there are something like 12 times more Church of England members in church every Sunday in Uganda than on the whole of the British Isles and North America combined. Stanley was later confronted by hundreds of well-armed warriors in war costume. Only the protection of Mutesa prevented a fight on this occasion. Later, as they discovered half-decomposed bodies with axe wounds, Mutesa's escort of canoes deserted Stanley. Yeah, these escorts are only good till there's a problem, but when you need them, they disappear. Within days, the expedition came under sustained attack, and Stanley wrote of a scene of rampant wildness and hideous verbosity beyond description. The boat was surrounded by a forest of spears. Over 50 bows were bent almost double with leveled arrows. Over 200 stalwart demons, as he described them, contended as to who should deliver the first blow. Stanley had to fight his way out of this desperate situation with his Winchester repeater rifle and shotgun. As they sought to row to safety, war canoes pursued them. With his elephant rifle, Stanley sunk boat after boat of his pursuers. For over 76 hours, they were without food before finding refuge. Upon completing their circumnavigation of the Lake Victoria, they were welcomed back to their base camp, only to discover that another of the Europeans had died, and many more of the expedition were suffering from dysentery. Attacks of fever reduced Stanley to a mere 108 pounds, barely 54 kilograms in weight. As they attempted to progress further into the Congo, several of the canoes proved to be rotten and sunk. In all, the expedition had lost 5 canoes, a case of ammunition, 1,200 pounds of grain, and 5 guns. The treacherous Bumbira tribe now attacked their party and killed a number of men. Stanley launched a counterattack. Then Mutesa asked for Stanley's support in dealing with the rebellious Wavuma tribe. By innovation and audacity, Stanley intimidated the Wavuma to surrender without any further bloodshed. He then persuaded Mutesa with his whole court, to completely convert to Christianity. Mutesa gave him an army of 2,000 warriors to escort his expedition to Lake Edward. After this, Stanley marched to Lake Tanganyika and completed the circumnavigation of the lake in 51 days, proving it was the longest freshwater lake in the world. Stanley had now been in Africa for 2 years, and he had accomplished 2 great geographic objects. He had explored and mapped both Lake Victoria and Lake Tanganyika. Now, without returning home, without even returning to the coast to refit the expedition, he prepared for the most audacious expedition of all, the exploration of the Congo River, the original heart of darkness. At this point, Stanley had already accomplished much, and he could have returned home with great honor. However, the fascination of the unexplored Lualaba River drew him. Was this part of the Congo? Was part of the Niger? Was part of the Nile River? Because the coast of Africa had been thoroughly explored, they knew it could only be one of those 3 rivers. It certainly couldn't be any other, because there's no other river big enough opening into the sea. No explorer had dared enter that notorious cannibal country of the Congo. Stanley was convinced that the fast-flowing broad Lualaba River must empty into the sea, and therefore could only be one of those 3 great rivers, the Nile, the Niger, or the Congo. Stanley was convinced that exploring the Lualaba River would be what Dr. David Livingstone would have wanted him to do. Yet he didn't have a single canoe to supplement the Lady Alice, which was a dissembled boat prefabricated. He would have to supplement his expedition with a force strong enough to give him a fighting chance of succeeding. To do so, he'd have to deal with Hamid bin Mohammed, known as Tipu Tip, a notorious slave trader. Tipu Tip was shrewd, unscrupulous, ruthless, and cruel. His slave raiders had killed many thousands and enslaved countless more. Tipu Tip and 700 of his men gave confidence to Stanley's expedition, who were threatening to mutiny rather than go down the dreaded heart of darkness. So, on the 5th of November, 1875, Stanley marched out of Nyangwe at the head of an expedition of nearly 1,000. By the second day, they were hacking their way through dense, thick jungle, which made every step painful. After a week of marching, they'd covered only 40 miles, 64 kilometers. Massive snakes, colossal trees, walking through darkness, forests so tall and so thick you couldn't see the sun. And the Lady Alice was dissembled into multiple pieces and had to be assembled at the end. This was quite a feat. The terrain became even more difficult as a dense jungle shut out every ray of sunshine. When they finally reached the Lualaba River, the Lady Alice was assembled. And while Stanley and the crew went by river, Tippitip and the bulk of the expedition continued parallel by land, which isn't as easy as it sounds because the riverbank would have been very dense foliage. Each village they passed seemed eerily empty. The inhabitants had apparently fled, but the rows of skulls lining the streets and the human bones littering the huts and yards spoke eloquently of the depraved nature of the inhabitants. They were in cannibal country. Where the Riki River empties into the Congo River, Stanley's path was blocked by war canoes filled with what he described as hostile savages who poured spears and arrows into his people. But as Stanley fired back, they fled. Smallpox broke out amongst the expedition. Soon they buried 12 of their number. But when they discovered that the cannibals dug up the bodies and ate them, they began practicing burial in the river. When they came across 6 old broken and abandoned canoes, they were repaired and used to transport the sick and wounded, but rapids overturned one of these canoes and 4 precious Snider rifles were lost. Despite difficulties in land and river, sickness and hostile attacks, the expedition pushed on. Tippitip and others pleaded with Stanley, turn back before it's too late. But Stanley was determined he was not going to give up. At Vinya Najara on the 18th of December, the expedition came under sustained attack. They constructed a barricade of logs and bush and beat off the savage attacks time and again. The yells of the attackers, the booming of the war horns, the crack of the rifles and the muskets, and the screams of the wounded created an unnerving, chaotic din. For 2 hours, they fought desperately before the attackers fled. Poisoned arrows continued to drop into the camp throughout the night. Sleep seemed impossible, but even under those conditions, many of the exhausted men dozed on and off. The next morning, Stanley set out in the Lady Alice to scout the area, and discovering a series of villages just a quarter of a mile down the river, he decided to capture the nearest village of his attackers. Seizing it, he fortified it, beat off several wild, determined attacks, and massive arrows flew into the village from the jungle, and 800 men in war canoes attempted to rush them. After beating both land and river attacks off, Stanley determined to make a night attack and to take their canoes. This would not only deprive the attackers of their mobility, but enabled his expedition to all travel on the river. That night, under cover of darkness, they cut loose 8 long canoes from one encampment, 26 canoes from the other. Some of these canoes were 50 feet long. By 5 in the morning, they were safely back in camp with 38 liberated canoes. At sunrise, they could hear the cries of rage from the savages, who had been deprived of their most cherished possessions. Now they were ready to accept Stanley's offer of peace terms. Stanley returned 15 of their canoes, paid them what he considered a fair price for the ones he kept. He also released the prisoners. However, at this point, Tippitip had decided he had had enough. He and his followers would go no further, and they determined to return east. He would also take back all the sick and the wounded. Now that Stanley had 23 canoes, he felt he could survive on his own. He made a speech to inspire his expedition. Into whichever sea this great river empties, there shall we follow it. You have seen that I've saved you a score of times when everything looked dark and dismal for us. If you risk your life, I risk mine too. It may be we shall meet 100 wild tribes yet, who for the sake of eating us will rush to fight us. We have no wish to molest them. If they fight us, we must accept it as an evil, like disease, which we cannot help. If we fight, we shall fight for our lives. We shall continue our journey that we shall toil on and on by this great river and to the salt sea. Stanley then declared a 3-day holiday in honor of Christmas 1876. with feasting, dancing, and canoe races. Each of the captured canoes were given names like Livingston, the Herald, Telegraph, Mattesa. Then, with the entire expedition on the river, they rowed forwards. Soon, war drums and war horns warned them of imminent attack. Eager young warriors with painted bodies and grotesquely adorned with the skins of wild animals screamed, "Meat, meat," as they massed for the attack. Stanley wrote that it must have appeared that they were a herd of ownerless cattle straying amongst the starving. He described the attackers as the living embodiment of hatred. In order to protect his people, Stanley ordered his men to collect shields after every battle. They were used to bulwark the canoes, making them look something like the galleys of the Vikings. By this stage, all distinctions between pagazi, or carriers, and askari, the soldiers, had vanished. Every man both rode and fought. Those that did not have guns captured spears and threw them back at the next hostile tribe they attacked. At one point, the expedition was attacked from both sides of the river, simultaneously. The attackers were painted half white and half red with broad black stripes. One war canoe was 85 feet long. As they targeted the Lady Alice, Stanley and his men fired a volley into the attackers. As the survivors leapt overboard, the massive canoe was captured and incorporated into the expedition's transport. Amongst the pounding of the drums, the screaming of the attackers, and the noise of battle came the ominous roar of a waterfall ahead. Attacked from both sides with an obviously high waterfall ahead of them, they were faced with a dilemma. Do you want to be drowned or do you want to be eaten by cannibals? Stanley determined to establish a beachhead and fight. They built a stockade and fought until sunset and through the night. Stanley scouted ahead and established that this was only the first of a series of cataracts. The seven cataracts were later named Stanley Falls. It took a month of hard fighting every day to carry their canoes and kit past every one of those waterfalls, fighting off hostile attacks in the dense jungle. By a series of bold attacks and outflanking maneuvers, Stanley required his men to sometimes be fighting 72 hours straight without a respite. At one point, Stanley surprised the attackers by capturing the village and holding their chief captive as a hostage until peace had been established. Stanley described the Iron Age culture in the Congo at that time. Baskets, fish nets, bundles of wooden spears with iron points, human skulls adorning the village streets, human ribs, thigh bones, vertebrae lay scattered around the huts. At one point, they found themselves surrounded by a huge net and a mass of men with spears hunting them like they were game. Sometimes their path had sharp pointed traps designed to injure or cripple them. You had to watch where you put your feet. The prisoners they captured had filed, sharpened teeth of cannibals, and rows of ugly tattoos marked their foreheads. He learned that these cannibals were unable to, when they were unable to capture strangers, they ate their own old men and women. Some of the photographs of some of the interesting designs and hairstyles, clothing, adornments, lack of clothing, and showing how the people lived there, some of the sketches. War dance ornaments that they had. They didn't have cameras in this expedition, but this is taken on a later one to show the kind of, you can see the kind of tattoos and body features that they have innovated as well, which fish hooks rubbed with ash, they'd pull out and make these different dots on the foreheads. These are pictures taken some years later of those same tribes. Gives you a bit of a feel for what interesting sights they were seeing. Attacks came thick and fast and sometimes with such intensity and in such numbers that had they not been prepared, they would have been overwhelmed. Savage screams filled the jungle and the drums were seldom silent. Finally, after a torturous month, the seventh and last waterfall was bypassed, and with the Congo River a mile wide, they relaunched their boats. There was a tremendous exhilaration amongst the expedition as they felt that the worst was behind them. But they were soon to learn that the worst was still ahead. Attacks increased in intensity. Poisoned arrows were shot at them at any time, day or night. They felt like hunted animals. Stanley rose to the occasion, clear-headed and calm in battle. confident that God was protecting him and that he was destined to complete his mission of ending the slave trade in Africa. By now, all his men had been hardened by travel and conflict and united into an effective fighting force and an efficient team. After a long series of battles and skirmishes, they faced one of their most desperate battles on the 1st of February, 1877. Worn by great shouting and thunderous beating of drums, they came around a bend close to where the Uruwini River joins the Congo. A fleet of gigantic canoes, bigger than anything they'd ever seen before, blocked their way. He formed up his boats in battle line, and with the Lady Alice 50 yards ahead, they confronted 54 battle canoes. Their largest canoe had 80 paddlers. As the monster canoe aimed straight for the Lady Alice, Stanley encouraged his men, "Be firm as I am. Wait until you see the first spear and then take good aim. Do not fire all at once. Keep aiming until you're sure of your man." As the monster canoe discharged a broadside of arrows, Stanley and his men opened fire. The enemy retreated out of range to reform for another attack. Stanley decided to preempt them by launching his own attack. In hot pursuit, Stanley's men forced the attackers' withdrawal into a rout. When the attackers made for shore, Stanley's men pursued them and chased them through the village and into the jungle. In many cases, the best form of defense is attack. At the village, they found a mesquite, a temple, with a large circular roof was supported by 33 tusks of ivory erected over an idol 4 feet high and painted bright red. This was the focus of the worship of the Basoko tribe. There were numerous skulls mounted on poles, a half-eaten human forearm and ribs on the fire. At this point, the expedition had traveled 340 miles north since leaving Nyangwe. The battle at the Aruima River mouth was the 28th battle in the Congo. 79 people had died on the expedition so far. They were still in the middle of the continent, and the exploration of the Congo River was not close to half completed yet. They still had a very long way to go, but Stanley was determined to never turn back. He kept up all details in his journal, writing, "I persist, trusting events to an ever-gracious providence." Storms threatened the canoes with destruction. A chronic shortage of food threatened starvation. However, at this point, they found friendly natives in the region of Rubunga who were willing to trade food for wire and beads, which they'd brought for that very purpose, bartering. Like other tribes they encountered the Congo, these people were elaborately tattooed. They'd never seen a white man before, but they had in their possession 4 antique Portuguese muskets, which they'd been traded for slaves. This greatly disturbed Stanley, as it indicated he might now begin encountering hostile tribes armed with muskets. His expedition's 20 rifles and 20 muskets would be inadequate if confronted by a large number of hostiles armed with firearms. The next tribe down the river, the Urungi, were also friendly, willing to trade, so the men of Stanley's expedition began to hope they're emerging out of the heart of darkness and entering into the outskirts of civilization. However, shortly after this, a shot rang out from an Urungi canoe and one of Stanley's men from Zanzibar fell dead from a ball fired from a musket. A few days later, on 14th February, the expedition was attacked by the most militant tribe in the Congo, the Bangala. The Bangala were the most brilliantly decorated warriors they had yet encountered. Their war cries resounded as their canoes advanced towards Stanley's men. Holding cloth in one hand and a coil of brass wire in the other, Stanley offered trade and peace. He had been told that the Bangala tribe liked to trade, but they actually liked to fight more. The battle continued throughout the afternoon. Stanley encountered 63 war canoes opposing them, each with an average of 5 muskets. That was 300 guns against 40. The Bangala were skillful and they were aggressive. However, after a 5-hour battle, the Bangala retreated. This was Stanley's 31st battle on the Congo. Very few professional soldiers have fought as many battles in a lifetime as Stanley had just fought in 4 months. Incredibly, although Stanley was in the forefront of every battle, standing in the prow of the Lady Alice, he came through every battle unscathed. Charmed life. 3 days later, they reached a lake which they called Stanley Pool. At this point, they had traveled 1,235 miles since leaving Nyangwe. Ahead of them were 32 more cataracts. Many canoes were lost, and injuries incurred as the boats were laboriously hauled overland past each of the waterfalls. At one point, Stanley fell 30 feet into a chasm, but miraculously escaped with only minor injuries. Their largest canoe, the Crocodile, was swept over a waterfall with the loss of 7 men, including his adopted son, Kalulu. The cataract was then called Kalulu Falls. The cataracts and the rapids were so numerous that the team developed a standard routine for transporting the canoes and the kits past them. A dangerous whirlpool was only narrowly escaped. When the Lady Alice survived going over a waterfall and somehow remained afloat, they named it the Lady Alice Rapids. From 16th of March to 21st April, the expedition traveled only 34 miles in 37 days. At one point, local and until then friendly natives advanced on camp with muskets, spears, and poisoned arrows and shrill war cries. Stanley asked them why they approached in such an aggressive fashion. Their reply was they'd seen the white man writing in a book. They demanded that he destroy his book because it was a bad omen and it meant that their goats would die. As Stanley had filled his journal with innumerable geographical calculations and sketches and details on tribes and languages and villages encountered, he could not sacrifice all the fruit of his trials and exploration. Nevertheless, he was compelled to agree to burn the offending book. He went to his tent, pulled out a well-worn edition of Shakespeare. As this was of similar size, with the same cover as journal, the natives did not realize the switch. They left with satisfaction when they saw the book burned to ashes. By now, their shoes were worn through, and Stanley and the sole remaining European on the expedition, Frank Pocock, were reduced to wearing makeshift sandals. Ulcers and sores developed on the soles of their feet, not surprisingly. At another waterfall, the last remaining European companion of Stanley was lost. Trying to steer around a treacherous whirlpool, Frank Pocock, the last surviving European member of Stanley's expedition, was lost. Most of the men on the expedition now fell into deep, dark despair after this accident. After all their diseases and battles and struggles against nature and heat and exhaustion and strain, the men threatened mutiny. 31 attempted to desert, but local chiefs would not allow them to pass through their territory. Soon the mutineers had to return, and Stanley attempted to inspire his tired, hungry, and discouraged men. In the next month, they traveled only 3 miles. Another 3 cataracts remained ahead. The tribes were sullen and uncooperative, unwilling to trade any food. All on the expedition were wasting away for lack of nourishment. There were only 116 people left on the expedition, and 40 were seriously ill. As they're apparently only a few miles from Boma, where there were apparently European settlers, Stanley sent messengers ahead requesting emergency food supplies. 2 days later, the messenger returned with pagazis bearing food and a message of welcome from the Europeans at Boma. This gave them strength to walk the remaining 3 days. On 9th of August, 1877, 999 days after their departure from Zanzibar, they were welcomed back to civilization by 4 white men who treated them to a banquet in Boma, which is basically on the coast of the Atlantic. He had gone from the Atlantic, from the Indian to the Atlantic, across the most treacherous, dangerous terrain on earth. They were then transported to Cabinda, and a ship carried them to Luanda, where they boarded another ship for Cape Town. And there, Stanley was welcomed and honored while a ship anchored in the bay, and a British warship carried the explorers from Cape Town to Zanzibar. The Cape of Good Hope, the Tavern of the Seas, played a role even in Stanley's expeditions. And this is a picture taken in Cape Town after that incredible expedition. Of the 359 people who had left Bagamoyo with Stanley 3 years before, only 82 returned to Zanzibar with him. 58 had been killed in battles with the cannibals, 49 had died of smallpox, 9 had starved to death, and 14 had drowned. Typhoid, fever, crocodiles, and other causes accounted for the rest. Never before, never since, has any African expedition accomplished so much, or at such cost. Stanley had surveyed the great rivers of Victoria and Tanganyika and the world's second longest river, the Congo. He had succeeded in exploring and mapping more territory than explorations of Burton, Speak, Grant, Bacon, even Livingston. The political and commercial implications of his geographic discoveries were immense. Stanley was only 37 years old when he completed his expedition from coast to coast, from ocean to ocean, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, across the heart of Africa, or the heart of darkness, as they put it. And this just shows the modern countries that and boundaries that he traversed and traveled across. Of all the great explorers, Stanley alone followed up his explorations by developing an empire. He determined to pour the civilization of Europe into the barbarian of Africa. Commerce would be used to bring Christianity and culture to the Congo. He described isolation as the great curse of Central Africa. European missionaries and businessmen needed to open up the great continent to civilization and free the Africans from animism, witchcraft, superstition, slavery, intertribal wars, and cannibalism. The 145,000 square miles of the Congo River Basin were comparable to the Mississippi and the Amazon in their scope. The 3,000 miles of the Congo River poured 12 million cubic feet of water into the Atlantic Ocean every second. It had tremendous potential for hydroelectric power. Africa could be freed by civilizing the Congo, which should be one of the richest countries on earth. In January 1878, Stanley was welcomed back to Europe by representatives of King Leopold II, King of the Belgians. King Umberto of Italy sent him an award. The Khedive of Egypt sent him a medal. All the geographic societies of Europe awarded Stanley gold medals. The Prince of Wales paid him tribute. Governments throughout Europe honored him. The Congress in the United States of America passed a unanimous vote of thanks for his achievements. Stanley was now the most famous African explorer alive. Just 4 months after his return, he submitted his manuscript for Through the Dark Continent, which in more than 1,000 pages and 2 volumes cataloged his incredible journey. And I've got those books in our library as part of our Rhodesia Heritage Library. In November 1878, King Leopold of the Belgians personally requested Stanley to please lead a venture to create a Congo Free State. In May 1879, Stanley arrived back at the mouth of the Congo River with less than 100 men, determined to bring civilization to millions of the most savage people on earth, living in one of the world's most remote and inhospitable regions. The debilitating furnace-like climate, the dense jungles, the treacherous rivers, the myriads of insects carrying fatal diseases did not dampen the enthusiasm and the vision of Stanley to bring civilization to the Congo. For 5.5 years, he labored to achieve this despite overwhelming frustrations. His efforts in the Congo earned him the name Bula Matari, or the Breaker of Rocks. Stanley had a reputation amongst his officers as a hard man. But his response was, one is not likely to be hard with persons who perform their duties. But it's difficult to be mild or amiable with people who are absolutely incapable and who will not listen to admonition without bristling with resentment. He was described as a man of iron, a man of courage, a man of dogged will, and a splendid leader. But while he was respectful of the customs and the traditions and the beliefs of the Africans, he was considered harsh to his fellow Europeans. And this was the same criticism basically given to David Livingstone. Very kind to the Africans, very harsh with the Europeans. As one man said, Stanley had no real friends, but he had many enemies. However long you might know him, I doubt you'll ever become his friend, said this person. Stanley could not understand, and he had little use for those who held their duty more lightly than he did. To him, duty was everything. He did not play cards or any game. He only read for recreation. Stanley negotiated over 400 treaties with the once warlike tribes along the Congo River, and this became the foundation of the Congo Free State. Peace, order, progress, and industrious work followed in his wake. He established 5 stations stretching over 450 miles and launched a steam and sailboat on the upper Congo River above Stanley Pool, and a road was built between Viva and Isangila. Even the wild and warlike Bangala made treaties with Bula Matari. Through his perseverance and his diplomacy and his patience and his understanding of the tribes of the Congo, he brought civilization to the tattooed and naked savages who had lived in barbarous depravity and cannibalism for centuries. Stanley was hailed worldwide as the emancipator, the liberator, had ended the rampant intertribal slavery and Arab slave trade, which had plundered the Congo for centuries. By the time his 5 years in the Congo was completed, Stanley had built a line of garrison stations for 1,400 miles up the Congo, establishing peace between tribes that had been in constant warfare for generations. He had established far-reaching political and commercial organization, built roads, railways, launched two steamers in the Upper Congo, three in the Lower Congo, bringing peace, commerce, and law to a land that once been wild and lawless. Stanley negotiated 400 treaties with the once warlike tribes along the Congo. These are pictures taken in 1901, showing some of the peoples that Stanley had brought civilization to. By force of his personality, in just 5 years, he had established peace between generations that had been at war. He established peace and commerce and law in a land that had long been feared as the most wild, lawless heart of darkness on planet Earth. These are some sketches showing some of what he had developed, like this is the beginning of Leopoldville, what today is called Kinshasa. He was hailed worldwide as the emancipator, the liberator, had ended the rampant intertribal slavery which had plundered the Congo for centuries. Matthew 10:28 says, "Do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell forever." And certainly Stanley feared God. He didn't seem to fear man that much. Missionaries and traders were venturing up the river, establishing trading posts and mission posts where no one would have thought it possible just a few years before. And all kinds of missions went into Congo, including C.T. Studd and Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, WEC, Heart of Africa Mission. And soon the Congolese were being taught to read, and brave missionary woman in the middle of these children that she's training. These are just showing some of the schools that were established. Stanley's choice of a successor was General Charles Gordon, who had been the Commandant General of the Cape at the castle back in the 1870s and 1880s. And Charles Gordon was en route to take over from Stanley when the Mahdi's rebellion in the Sudan forced him to change his plans and head for his fatal date with destiny in Khartoum. Stanley regretted that many of his ideals and the principles of David Livingstone, which he had sought to honor, were betrayed by some of the men who followed him. In 1910, King Leopold persuaded the Belgian government to take over responsibility for administering the Congo. Interesting that King Leopold was hailed in his time as the most Christian and the most generous of sovereigns in the world, because he bankrupted himself with his personal fortune to make possible a Congo Free State when the Belgian government and country were not willing. It was at one time King Leopold's money alone that made the Congo Free State, because the Belgian government wasn't interested. But by 1910, King Leopold was bankrupt. He needed the government to take over the Congo. They didn't do as good a job as Stanley had done, though. Incredibly, that was not the end of the African adventures of Henry Morton Stanley. He later crossed Africa from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean to rescue one of General Gordon's governors, Emir Pasha. And that expedition was an extraordinary one. That epic endurance started out with an expedition of 708 men, ended with 196, 512 died en route. The afflictions, diseases, and battles endured on the Emin Pasha rescue compared with Stanley's exploration of the Congo. And I've got that book too. Stanley and his men were welcomed to German East African Bagamoyo with the guns of German warships in the harbor, which boomed out the salute to the epic explorer. He then wrote In Darkest Africa, a 903-page phenomenal story. And I mean, that's something else. Don't have time for today, but this is the map of his Emin Pasha relief expedition, 1887 to 1889. He noted one of the most encouraging aspects of this trans-African expedition was visiting the mission station of Reverend Alexander Mackay in Uzambiru in Uganda. Mackay had been in Africa for 12 years in response to Stanley's urgent plea for missionaries after the conversion of Kabaka Mutesa. Stanley described Mackay as the best missionary since Livingstone. High praise indeed from someone who knew Stanley, knew Livingstone personally. He is known as the wizard of the Great Lake because of his engineering abilities. Alexander McKay survived 12 years. Of his original mission team of eight, within 2 years, he is the only one left. All the others had died or been killed. One of the churches established by McKay, Stanley observed that the virtues of civilization never seem so clear as when he is in the jungle, but the wilds of Africa never seem so pleasant as when he is in the midst of civilization. A man torn between the two, and I think we understand that, we who are of Africa. We love the bush, we love Africa, but of course sometimes we miss some things of civilization. Stanley met with England's Prime Minister, William Gladstone, urged him to build a railroad from Mombasa on the east coast to the shore of Lake Victoria to help suppress the slave trade. At the age of 49, less than 3 months after his return to England from this last great African expedition, he married the talented and beautiful Dorothy Tennant at Westminster Abbey, 12th of July, 1890. Dorothy Tennant was a descendant of Oliver Cromwell. Stanley received honorary degrees from Edinburgh, Hale, Durham, Oxford, Cambridge. He conducted lecture tours of the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. In 1895, he was elected a Member of Parliament for North Lambeth, London. But he's a man of action, he wasn't a politician. He accomplished far more by his writings than by his speeches in Parliament. And his book, Slavery and the Slave Trade in Africa, was effective in mobilizing the political will and action necessary to finally crush the last remnants of that vile trade in Africa. In his autobiography, he wrote, "Those to whom I ventured to consign the secret hopes and interests of my heart invariably betrayed me. I learned by experience that there was no love for me, born to, so to say, fatherless, spurned and disowned by my mother, beaten almost to death by my teacher and guardian, fed on the bread of bitterness. How was I to believe in love? But I was not sent in the world to be happy, nor to search for happiness. I sent for a special work." In 1897, he paid his last visit to Africa to take part in the ceremonies opening the Bulawayo Railway Station in southern Rhodesia. His last book was Through South Africa, published in 1898. And there he is in Rhodesia Railway's carriage with his wife. He was a great enthusiast for the great civilizing work of what Cecil John Rhodes was accomplishing. He was a friend of Salu, the great scout of Rhodesia, and that was his last visit to Africa, was coming to Matabeleland and seeing the advances made there. In 1899, at the age of 58, Stanley was knighted by Queen Victoria. Now think, this is a Welsh boy who was in a poorhouse, who was born without either father or mother acknowledging him, cast out. He was in the lowest of the lowest in a very rigid class structure, yet he rose to being a Member of Parliament and knighted by the Queen. Extraordinary. He died on the 10th of May, 1904, at 63 years old. He was the most famous convert of Dr. David Livingstone, one of the greatest explorers of all time, one of the most effective campaigners against the slave trade ever. His 1874 to 1877 Trans-Africa exploit was the most outstanding achievement in the history of the exploration of Africa. This is his burial stone in England. Very simple. Henry Morton Stanley, Bula Matari, and then Africa. And that's in the cemetery where he is in Britain. You think of the scripture of 2 Timothy 1:7, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." Stanley rose over all disadvantages to be a person who did not fear man. These are some lectures I've given on him. These are some of my sources. The autobiography of Sir Henry Morton Stanley by Dorothy Stanley, his wife. The British Expedition to Abyssinia, which was written by one of the captains who was involved. Stanley's book on Kumasi, that's the Abyssinian campaign in Magdala, which is the battles in the Ashanti. His book, How I Found Livingstone Central Africa, I have that book too. Explorations and Adventures of Henry Morton Stanley. There have been children's books too written on him, but the best are his actual volumes on Through the Dark Continent. The originals have got the maps, the charts, the original. The modern ones they've made are devoid of the original illustrations and maps, making them far less attractive. This book as well, one of my prized possessions in darkest Africa. And absolutely extraordinary. This is the first edition. And of course, Henry Morton Stanley's great mentor, David Livingstone, his books as well. So these are just some of my books that I've got on Henry Morton Stanley, which have helped me put together these different presentations. So any questions, any comments on Henry Morton Stanley? Most welcome. Well, I would say he's the most successful journalist in history. If you to think, who's the greatest journalist in history? Could anyone think of someone? I've asked many a journalist, who do you think is the greatest journalist in history? And they've mentioned sometimes a contemporary person, said, what do you think of Henry Morton Stanley? And they've all once, they've thought of it, said, it's true. There's no greater journalist in history. But he didn't just write history, he made it. Yeah. By the way, just to show you the mentality of people, in Denbai, which is his birthplace, some Rastafarian-looking commie has attacked and destroyed the statue of Henry Morton Stanley. Now, who is more famous from Denbai? Had he even heard of Denbai? Do you know if anyone else was born in Denbai? But why would Denbai want to remove a statue to their most famous son who accomplished so much? The people who accomplish things, and then there are people who can build and the people who break down.
Yeah.
You know. Well, I don't know if you ever saw, but there was one interesting TV film, Forbidden Territory, which is told through the eyes of Stanley just up to his finding of Livingstone, which is actually well worth seeing. It's a good film, but nobody yet has attempted to do a film on the early life of Stanley or of his great Trans-Africa expeditions. I mean, it would be quite a challenge. It would need quite a budget. But what a story. Think of all the garbage that Hollywood produces. Why don't they focus on some of the great adventures and achievements of a man like Stanley? So, I've got a few Facebook pages up, like for Dr. David Livingstone and our Livingstone Fellowship. We have quite a few things there. This presentation and audio and PowerPoint will be up on our frontlinemissionsa.org audio and video gallery, which is up there. If anyone wants to get to it, as soon as I get this edited, we'll upload and make it available for people to share. Any other comments, questions? Ms. Stanley?
Do you know what I think he did is that everyone knows David Livingstone, go to Livingstone, you know what I mean, see the falls, and yet Stanley,
you know, he was the most respected man of his age, and today it's like he's one of the most attacked and despised or ignored. Isn't that extraordinary how times can change like that? But also, what I like about Stanley's life is he shows us what Africa was like before Christianity and civilization and culture came, and what a difference Africa made, taking Africa out of the Stone Age and out of such rampant cruelty into the space age. So people like Stanley should be honored throughout Africa. And it's a great pity that they've renamed Stanleyville to, what is it now, Lubumbashi? No? No, that's Elizabethville. It's, what is, what have they renamed Stanleyville to? No, it's not Kinshasa. It's the one right up, Lubumbashi is the old Elizabethville down below in Katanga, high up. Oh, they've got a different name. I've just blanked my mind a moment. But why rename a city like Stanleyville, one of the most honorable and greatest achievers in history? And who did more for Africa than Stanley and Livingstone? Yeah. Best friends Africa ever had.
Yeah,
well, but it must be filmed sometime, because what a story. Yeah. What a story. Yeah.